All right, we're back.
Okay, sorry about this.
So we're discussing the word love.
Okay, so yeah. So I'm getting back to the idea from Crowley's Book of the Law and from what are called, for anybody who wants to look it up, if anybody wants to know what reality is, all they need to do is read Liber Oz, basically. It's a very short. Every word is a single syllable long. That's all there is to it. There's a less than 200 words in the article, Liber Oz. And in it, it closes with the words, "Do as thou will shall be the whole of the law. Love is the law, love under will." Now, if we accept the progression of the teleology, if we accept that all of these occult mysteries, that this mystery school, that this mystery world we're living in emanates from a single principle, then we have to consider that to be the most up-to-date. It is the most up-to-date expression of the law. The Book of the Law, supposedly written by Iwas, and you know, that's ayahuasca, right?
Really?
Sure, ayahuasca, ayahuasca.
It's pretty good, man.
Okay, so according to this book, which was dictated to Crowley by Iwas, and then the subsequent bottom, or the section taken out of it, which is called the Book of, or the Liber Oz, love is the law, love under will. Now, so we need to understand what the meaning of the word love is and the meaning of the word will, all right? We already understand what law is, because what law means is the parameters in which we are allowed to act, okay? So, love, what does that mean? Well, the word love derives from the egg, the word egg. In tennis, when they say love, it means luf, which means the egg, right?
Okay.
All right. The egg, which is the basis of creation, which is the basis of life, the beginning of life. And, of course, the sexual act of procreation inseminates an egg. And, of course, we all call that making love, right? But, of course, that's not the only kind of love, because ultimately love becomes the fact that you live. That's what it is. So it turns out that life is the law.
Okay.
And we can see that telegraphs, that comes in a straight line right out of the words of Christ himself, who said, "I am a God of the living, not a God of the dead." Okay? So it is the repudiation of death is the law, basically. That's what it is. Now, you can see immediately, and if you read the Book of the Law, you can see the variety of ways in which that could be practiced. Okay? The Book of the Law is very short, so I highly recommend, or no, the Liber Oz.
Okay. You know, I was thinking about the Book of the Law. I remember when I bought my copy, and I swear to God, I was in Chicago, and I bought the book, and I couldn't wait to sit down and start to read it. And as I was walking up the block, I ducked into a falafel joint. And as I order my food and I'm about to eat, I look to my right, and painted on the wall is Dorothy and her three companions walking up a gold brick road off to the Emerald City. I mean, just the whole wall. And I mean, one could say, oh, you know, the whole argument.
See, such a vision could bring someone to their knees.
Oh, it was something else. I mean,
yeah.
So I remember finishing the book sometime the next day, and it says in the back of that book, you're not supposed to read it again.
Yes.
Doesn't he make that?
You're supposed to burn the book after you read it.
You're supposed to burn the book after you read it. So, which is a nice little...
Well, first of all, that is Crowley's edition. That bit of the book was not publicized, according to Crowley, by Iwas. That's a preface to the book that Crowley himself wrote. But anyway, go on.
But that ties in nicely to that comment that we discussed earlier about Kubrick's films being meant to be seen but once.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
I guess
sure.
We're fine.
I guess we're fucked, man. Oh, he even told us when we fucked up.
Well, but, absolutely. That's the beauty of it. It's a seduction.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. True gnosis is not strictly pleasant.
No.
Seeing the world the way it really is not a strictly pleasant experience. It can fill you with it. It's very much, and I can speak to this from real experience, because I was an avid mountaineer, and I'm talking the real McCoy. I mean, going straight up the cliffs and all that shit. And gnosis is very, very similar to climbing a mountain. One of the first things about climbing is a mountain is you cannot see the top until you get there. The actual summit will be obscured to you by the mountain itself until very shortly before you actually arrive there. And by then, it's already too late because you're there, right? And this is very much like gnosis. And there's no surprise that Crowley was a real mountaineer, like a world-class mountaineer. I can't make that claim myself. He claims to be the first person to have ever climbed K2, and I think he might be telling the truth.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who seem to back that up.
Yeah, so, and he went solo, if he did go. I mean, this guy was serious about finding out what's at the top, basically. You know, because that is it's not the highest mountain, but it's the most difficult mountain in the world to climb. Hardly anybody survives it, basically. Less than 1 in 10 people who even try to climb it come off alive. That's how difficult it is. Research, I'm not exaggerating in the slightest. It's just a death trap. That's it. So anyway, so I can't always, so we were talking about, what was the main point before I meandered?
Well, the notion of mountain climbing and the way it incorporates adrenaline and that McKenna says, no one enters into an ashram with their knees knocking. No one sets apart to meditate.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful.
And there's doubt and there is nervous tension and there's like, I don't know where this is going to go. And the absolute fear mixed with the possibility of ecstasy is unique
absolutely
to only a
that
few
is
certain
it,
things.
That's it. You've got to, and you know, to go back to the beginning again, as I like to do, the Bible says, and I can't quote the exact book, but you know, it's an important phrase. I think it's the most important phrase in the entire book, and that is the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God.
I agree with you completely.
You can put into, ultimately, you can strike out God and put principle, right? The principle, whatever the principle is, whatever it is that's holding together this extraordinary structure of our reality, whatever's really at the top, has to be something fearsome. It has to be something that is capable of managing what is beyond impossible, essentially. And that is a fearsome thing. It's not just lollipops, sunshine, and roses. Sure, there's some of that on the way, but there's going to be some serious bumps in the road as well. And I think that when you've truly cracked open your head and had that dark night, those bumps don't hurt as much anymore. I was reading about a funny kind of internet meme about Keanu Reeves, you know, that sad Keanu thing. The guy's had a really tragic life. And of course, he's always playing a superhero that saves the world or a psychotic killer. Perfect pairing, right? So anyway, somebody was asking him, you know, how do you manage to go on with all the terrible things, the misfortunes that you've had happen to you? And he goes, well, some people have to be happy to live. I don't, basically. And I think that that's a very important key. Something that I feel is misleading for those seeking to break open their head is that if you just think it's going to make you happy and everything's going to be, then you might be a little bit misled, possibly. And that there is something about it that is almost lawful. You know, this is the thing, we all want access to some kind of law, right? But what could that law really be but something other than fearsome? Because that's what it does, it keeps you in line. It says, look, you're here to live, you know, and you better fucking live. Otherwise, I'll waste you, you mofo. And it's that frightening, you know. It's that you better want to live and you better keep living because that's what we do here, we live. And, you know, in the book of Revelation, when John of Patmos is having his first vision and supposedly the angel Michael is showing him and he's struck by the vision and he falls to his knees and the angel says, get off of your knees. We do not do that here, basically. So this is about an understanding. It's really ultimately about saying it's a confrontation and ultimately it becomes an apocalypse. That's what it is. The experience is apocalyptic. And ultimately, it's apocalypse now. You know, that's what reality, the real reality is, apocalypse now. I know you dig that.
No, yeah, right on, man. Absolutely, absolutely. You took the words right out of my head, man. I think that speaks a lot to just how unprofitable entheogens are on the so-called drug market. There is no economic war on psychedelics.
No, there's not. They're not even trying to stop people from getting at it.
Not even close. You remember,
as a matter of fact, it's being promoted, and the promotion of it is tricky, to say the least. But it ought to be. It ought to be, because you better have your eyes wide open going into this. And you know, a while back when I was praising what I believe to be your virtues, I like to. I like to idealize people that I like. It's just, it's a thing I do, basically. It's probably not, you know, but whatever. But anyway, I was going to add to that that the reason that I brought up all those things about you is because I'm not such a nice person. I mean, I have gone full-scale Tyler Durden in my life, basically. And, you know, I have literally peed in the proverbial soup. And when I say literally, I actually mean literally. I mean, I'm a sinner. Basically, that's what I am. And I would like to say to everyone out there, I think this might be true. You know, this experience wakes you up, not just to the magical world that you think is out there. It does that, but it also wakes you up to you and the person that you are. And you'd better be ready for the transition, because it can hurt. It can hurt if you're living in a kind of a delusion where you think, oh, I'm a good person, you know, I'm sunshine, lollipops, and rainbow. The Christ consciousness is touching me. That's what I thought was happening. I thought I was having a mystical, wonderful experience, and boy, did I get slammed. I got slammed hard by sinks that I dare not even repeat what happened in them, because it pushes me into the realm of the person who becomes, almost has to become a hermit. Because once you start talking about that kind of stuff, people just, they look at you just a little bit sideways from that point onward.
Well, and I think this will be a nice way to kind of tie up today's conversation, is that if we both agree that we are now once again living in a global village, and yes, that people no longer will be having jobs, people will go back to having roles.
Yes,
because in a,
absolutely,
that is
very apt. I've never heard that said. Is that your own thought?
I think it's essentially straight McLuhan. That,
okay, well, that's, I didn't, you see, you're good on McLuhan too. I was born in the same place as McLuhan, but
okay, I love that.
But I'm not an expert on his work, and that's very apt. Yes, I believe that it has what is happening. Going back into a world where we play roles. It's the Menippean, the great Menippean satire.
It has to be, because when a child is born, and if their parents are paying attention, if the village is paying attention, every child, they say, you were born to play this role.
Yes,
you are not born to work in a factory. You are born to play a role. And that speaks to the fun of a child, and it speaks to the passion of the actor. And that is what we were made for.
And all the world's a stage.
And all the world's a stage. And death is just a big a part of it as life, but it is the play. It is the drama. It is the comedy. It is the tragedy. It's all there. So as we are pulling ourselves out of this, you know, the assembly line carnage of 2,000 years, or however you want to bracket it, we are returning to our roles. And I think, you know, like I said, your role that you play, it's not meant to be at the club on a Friday night. And
definitely,
it's not meant to be at the water cooler at the office.
it's the whole shebang. That's the thing.
You know what I mean? There are... fringes touching fringes. The shaman and the rabbi and the hermit that whose geographical position on this stage is on the fringe, we are lucky enough to have more access points. So, you know, I think that coming to... It's like that whole notion of, I forget who said it. I think they were talking about McKenna, but that the supposed end date of 2012 or what we're going through right now, time is like the passenger of a car that got into a head-on collision. It's moving forward and then backward and forward and backward, but eventually it's going to come to rest. And once that turbulence stops, we can survey the damage and fix it. And so that's what's going on right now. You and I definitely have felt our face go through the windshield. And we definitely spent our time in the hospital addressing literal physical injuries due to that rude awakening. Yes. But we have, after that, now having some time and space, I think our thoughts are coming to a more stable position. And I think we both know that there are people around us that, and like I said, I would love to be wrong about this, but I don't think I am, that there's a lot of people who are about ready to go through the windshield. Because of the way the world is moving towards, it's time. There's no more kids' gloves around this. It's time.
McLuhan, the one book of McLuhan's that I've actually held, I can't remember what it was called. It's a very small volume. I picked it up, and it's got a quotation right at the beginning from James Joyce. It's that weird word, Ragnarok.
Yeah.
I don't know. I got it at that moment. I picked up that book, and I went, oh, even though I didn't get it in the gut, because this was before, right before things started to really happen for me. And picking up that book probably had something to do with it. But I got it. If we all start to groove on the same groove stick, if it really is a global village, it's an apocalypse. That's what it is. It's a complete reordering of reality in such a way that to assume that it's not going to have some negative aspect to it is a little bit childish, I think. And and in this sense, you know, going back to the Tarot and to the whole concept of what's coming now, right? I hate to say I believe it's coming now. You're kind of hinting at the same thing in your very intellectual and Fred Astaire-ish kind of way. But you know, I'm going straight down the middle with this here. I think the S is about to hit the F, basically. You know.
See, I think the S already hit the F.
Well, the S did hit the F, but it has, the blowback is not yet complete. Okay. Essentially, the poo hasn't started to stick on everyone yet, and it's about to. Because it's the power of denial has what has taken us this far. It should have happened with 2001. It should have happened with September 11th. That should have been enough right there. Everybody should have gone, uh-oh, I see it now. It's as clear as a fucking bell, quite frankly. But nope, that wasn't enough, essentially. And of course, many people are still living in a complete state of delusion about those events, including a lot of truthers. Who think that George Bush and the Bush family pulled the strings? Those guys are puppets. They are characters in the play, just like us. Yes. Essentially, they are playing their roles too. Essentially, and we all do have a role in this game. And what I mean about apocalypse is this: one of the cards in the tarot is judgment. Okay, and judgment is judgment. That's what it is. And all you have to do to be prepared for judgment is one thing: confront yourself.
Yeah.
Stop lying to yourself. And most people believe that they're not doing that. That's the thing, but they are. They are doing it. Because they believe that it's somehow going to be about them at the end. They're just holding that one ace to their card where they're going to say, it's me that Oprah's going to invite on her show next week.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's me that's going to lead that little revolution. It's me that's going to have that moment where God pats me on the shoulder and says, you done good, kid. And that's where judgment is going to sneak up and get you. That's where it got me in a devastating way, believing when these things started to happen to me that it was about me in some way, essentially.
That is what the Western mind, when it breaks open the head, when it starts to add up everything that's happening, and from my own experience, is that subtly your ego gets in the way and you look through all of history through your own personal lens. And, I was Jesus on the cross, but I condemned and put him on the cross.
It's complex. It's a complex matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does seem that languaging this experience has become the obsession of the artist of our century.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And the fact that we can be so conversant with such an ineffable experience, and the genius of someone like McKenna to be able to language it, but even he came upon a frustration of how far you could language it. Unfortunately, or fortunately, Joyce's Finnegan's Wake seems to be, the more you spend time with it, it is the expression. It is the expression. And
in literary form.
It's to draw it down onto the two-dimensional page. And
look, here's what Finnegan's Wake is. Just for all of you listeners out there, Finnegan's Wake is the proper translation of the Bible. That's all it is. It's the proper translation into English of the Bible.
That's beautiful.
He was not steeled in the school of old Aquinas for nothing, basically.
That is beautiful. I think of it as
purgative.
I think of it as 3.0 or 2.0, Bible 2.0.
Yeah.
And it's just like, if you had a Bible to give to someone in the year 220 who'd never even seen a book, well, their expression is a lot like trying to give Finnegan's Wake to someone and say, here, read this. I mean, it just doesn't happen. It's like McLuhan says.
True.
And this is the trick that Joyce played. He's, when you get locked into the world of literacy, when the world programs you to be literate, there's a particular phenomenon and a particular sense ratio that you have in your head that is now all of a sudden different. You look at nature, but when you open a book, you don't look at a book, you read a book. Your eyes do something different. They have been programmed. Yeah. The problem is when you lift your eyes from the pages of that book, do you go back to looking or do you continue
to read?
That's
exactly the point. Once you learn to read, you're reading everything.
You're reading and everything.
And then after that comes what's implied by Kubrick.
Yes.
And obviously we're not going to continue into that, but the concept of Eyes Wide Shut, which I believe is the death knell of cinema in the exact same way that The Finnegan's Wake is the death knell of the written word. Everything now, all movies exist within Eyes Wide Shut. And here's the thing, because Eyes Wide Shut becomes a film that's impossible to interpret in any way except your own.
Exactly. It's like they could say about Ulysses, this is pornography. Well, show me the passage. Okay, someone could say, I see what you're seeing, but that's up to discretion of what is obscene and what is pornography. You give someone Finnegan's Wake, and they say, this is pornography. And they go, well, show me the passage. They show you the passage.
They can't even find it.
And they go, well, what does that mean? Now, all of a sudden, you're looking into the dirty mind of the person who's seeing pornography in three sentences of Finnegan's Wake.
Exactly.
It's just absolutely brilliant, man.
Yeah. And I mean, we are living in a world now in which the image, and it says, you know, I think it was Confucius who said, the true language is the language of symbols. That's what Kubrick was trying to completely codify. I believe he did that in his films. And I believe the influence of that is permanent, quite frankly. Just as the work of James Joyce is expressive of reality, so are Kubrick's films in the sense of proposing the visual codified symbolic image, basically.
So
as opposed to the written
in the tarot.
So and that's what leads to the sink, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
Now, when you look away from the movie, and this is happening with every film now, because even if they're shitty Michael Bay films, they all have these same codes built into them.
Yes.
And we could go on about this forever. That's another matter. But the fact of the matter is, when you look away from the film now, whether you like it or not, you're seeing that world.
Perfect. It's a lot like, I'm trying to think of if I had to label it in this way. The four aces contain the other 52 cards of the minor arcana in the trump, correct?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So if we were going to have our four aces of contemporary tarot as expressed outwardly, Finnegan's Wake could be a literary ace. All books are contained within Finnegan's Wake. Kubrick's film work is an ace. All films and all visual.
What you do is there only need to be four aces because it's a cube.
Yes, right?
they're the corners of our dimensional reality. So in time, you may have the ace being something else.
Yes, exactly. But for right now, it's like the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You know, the four gospels.
Absolutely.
They no longer are preaching the gospel. Fuck Mount Rushmore. I mean, but that's what that is, right?
Sure, absolutely.
The forefathers.
Very good.
But I think you would put chess as every game you can see reduces to a chess match. Boxing, everything.
Yes.
In every sport, chess is embedded. So chess would go as one of those aces. So I've got The Wake, I've got Kubrick, I've got chess.
You're a chess player.
I'm not a chess player. The only move is not to play, right? That's how my mind worked for so long.
I hear you. I'm with you on that.
I mean, it's just, it's...
See, but, I think at the center, you are right. We really actually do agree. I'm surprised to find that, but it seems like we agree on everything. I mean, and this is the thing, you know, I like to try to make my way of expressing it be the right one. I think, you know, it's a lot of fun to try and do that, but yeah, we're basically on the same page.
Yeah, no, it's such a great to see reflection like that is
it's self-affirming.
Yeah,
it makes you feel a little bit safer, maybe just
absolutely
a little bit more comfortable with just how awesome this really is.
Yeah, because as I've tried to explain, well, you know, I think this is where we'll finish today, is that most people don't know the two sides of Timothy Leary's most famous meme or slogan for what was occurring. Turn on, tune in, drop out. And then they said, what do we do after that? He said, find the others. Find the others. And then you begin again. The problem was that finding the others was so fraught with danger, with confusion, disinformation, distrust, mistrust, bad experiences, that a lot of people just became hermits.
Mm.
And people just said, you know what, I'm going to move out into a farm, or I'm just going to grow some vegetables and just I'm going to give this thing up. Now that this technology, this internet is here, it's connecting the others. So the synchromystic community is just the first emergence of the others starting to find each other. And
right.
So
I think that is a great place to close. I mean, I think that's fantastically true. I want to add to that. You can close things up, but I want to add to that, consider the implication of what it means to be one of the others.
That's beautiful. All right, Mark, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, this was great, Bill. Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed it.
And we'll do it again soon.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, later.